This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and Bradley is unfortunately not with us at the moment. I say unfortunately, but in fact his wife has just had the baby that they've been expecting for a while, and he's taken a few weeks off. So for the next couple of shows, we're going to have a couple of sit-in guests for Bradley, and tonight I'm delighted to be joined by Don Orth, a friend of mine from Hillbrook School in California. Before I bring Don in, I just want to mention that we have a new sponsor for the show as well. Tap Typing is an app that teaches students how to type properly on the iPad. To learn more about it, go to gettaptyping.com or just search for typing on the App Store. It's going to be the first result for that search. And we'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Bradley was in fact so excited about this sponsor that he took some time out of his parenting schedule to record a drop-in sponsor read for that sponsor. So you'll hear from Bradley halfway through the show, even though he's not on the show. So Don, welcome to Out of School.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm in Northern California. I'm director of technology at a JK through 8 independent school. We're deep in the heart of Silicon Valley. Have about 315 students on our campus. iPads in middle school, grades 5 through 8. And, well, one-to-one iPads there. And we have a shared iPad program in the lower grades and doing all sorts of fun stuff. And it's great. It's great to be kind of moved up from Southern California a few years ago and kind of dove into the whole Silicon Valley world. And it's a wild place, a lot of energy, and it's busy.
So let me ask you a first question about that. How do you feel that... being a technology director running a school with these kind of programs in Silicon Valley is a different proposition to doing it elsewhere?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't, you know, I've done this, kind of been in this role in Switzerland actually a bunch of years ago. So kind of before the whole revolution, I think, at least iPads. And I think for one thing, there's a lot of collaboration going on. I think we've realized that we're all doing and kind of moving in the same direction or trying to do the same kinds of things and revolutionize education. And so there's a ton of opportunities for collaboration. There's so many schools here. And I would say that one of the distinguishing characteristics, you have a lot of startup companies really working hard to understand needs of educators in particular. So we have, we've had the opportunity to work with a lot of companies and kind of talk to them, test a lot of different software and hardware out, and we really feel like they're responsive, they're interested. But I think that's probably more and more the case across the landscape of education in general right now.
Yeah, I think it is. It's certainly something that we have, from time to time, been approached with. Occasionally we do it. Most often we don't, just because we, at our school, we don't really have the scale to give people a very good test of their stuff. You know, sometimes what we'll see is very early things, prototypes and things like that, and often we can be useful at that scale, but when people really want to do a sort of torture test of their stuff, they need to look to a bigger school than ours. But it's certainly, you know, I think we all know that there's a big move into startup world and in business, for that matter, into trying to bring technology into education. I mean, even Rupert Murdoch's into it now with his tablet, so it's definitely something that's moving along.
Well, I think
we'll get into talking about some of those later.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that I think more and more folks are paying attention to the client. I think in the past, when business was easy, or when it has been easy, you know, it's just been like, oh, let's produce this thing, and you know, the client's going to have to deal with it or figure it out. Now there's such a demand from the client, you know, from schools. They're really asking kind of harder questions and expecting sophisticated products. And I think companies are really trying to understand. And the nice thing, again, about being in Silicon Valley is the companies are here. You know, they're right around the corner. So we have certainly the folks that we are really interested in their products. They're on our campus. We're talking. We have a personal relationship with them. And it's exciting. Even if we're not using their products, it's nice to be able to talk in that kind of space and talk about the advancements and different pieces they're working on.
Yeah, that's always, you know, a lot of the time when we do that kind of thing, it's you know, a very scheduled Skype call across multiple time zones, but having them all on your doorstep must be quite a benefit.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a lot of fun, and it's just, again, there's that energy, that startup company energy. A lot of our parents and kids are kind of in that world too. It's where a lot of the parents work, so you have a lot of that energy coming in. It's challenging as well because you have you know, parents who know that world well and have certain expectations and opinions about what it should look like. So those are conversations that sometimes happen as well.
Do you do anything special to resolve that kind of tension? I mean, I guess you may end up, I've certainly ended up in situations before where, you know, there's one teacher in the school who's somebody works for a certain company who provides a certain technology and you know, they push very hard for those technologies for reasons other than necessarily the school's best interest, perhaps. I don't know. Don't give away any confidences.
Right.
But
this is public, right? There's only so much I can say.
I may have to
here.
Edit some of this.
That's right.
Do you have sort of parents information sessions, or do you bring parents in before you make decisions?
Yeah, you know what, we've been building up to that now, and we're actually just getting ready to put in place kind of a an emerging technology parents committee. And that, I feel, you know, there's a ton of expertise and a ton of experience, and obviously it's not always relevant to schools, and often solutions that are fantastic just don't apply. I think most parents understand that, although I've had some folks come in and say, you know, this is the solution you should use for like digital workflow or something like that. Usually they're seeing it from, you know, their company's point of view and feel like this is the best product for not usually a school is really what it comes down to. But I love talking to them. Often they come in and really there's always something to be gained, I think, on our side, and also by the parents or other companies. You know, there's always a shared experience or shared information that we both benefit from. So, we don't have a form and fill this out and we'll get back to you kind of thing. Although maybe it's worth doing at some point. But again, I'm excited for this kind of emerging technology parents group because we have some really interesting folks with some very cool experience.
And does that take the form of a kind of sit-down conversation with a certain group?
Exactly. That's the plan. It really, ideally, what it's going to be is, you know, we'll say, you know, we're really interested in, you know, video conferencing, for instance. What is the, you know, here's our capacity. Here's kind of our resources. What's out there? What works well? What are some of the different things you can do that we might need as a school? And then we get folks talking about it and bring in their experience. You know, one of the other things that we may we'll probably go into later is, you know, we're trying to evaluate learning spaces and analyze video. So one of the conversations we've started now is, can we get something that can turn video data into kind of hard numbers? So I don't know if it exists yet, but we're working on trying to build something that will work like that.
That sounds like something you might want to try and find some parents who are defense contractors.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Where are
that
the missiles?
More East Coast thing than West Coast thing.
Well, it's like, right? It's like that. It probably exists somewhere. It's just not available to the public. But how cool would that be to kind of analyze movement within a class and to see how different environments change behavior?
I think that's certainly a research topic that somebody should get into for sure, because I know the way a lot of schools get built over here is they get very much built to a contract, and I've been to some schools which are very new, and they are honestly like, you know, I mean, I hesitate to say the word prisons, but some of them look a little bit like that.
But that's what schools are. They got to keep the kids in, man, or else they'll just run off.
I don't think you're allowed to lock the doors, though.
Come on.
Violation of the fire code.
there's that. But if you give everybody collars, that will automatically open the doors. It'll be good.
Well, that could work. So, you know, your school's very much not like that. Your school's about as far away from a prison as I could imagine. I think it's probably one of the most beautiful schools I've ever visited. I was quite lucky to visit you.
Yeah, it was great to have you.
It was about a year ago now.
And
I was just bowled over by the sort of idyllic setting that you work in.
Yeah, it is. Super lucky. And it's, you know, the kids, you know, our headmaster often says the kids don't walk, you know, from one place to another. They're running everywhere. So there's this kind of beautiful spot in the middle of campus called the Village of Friendly Relations, where I think there are about four or five houses that 50 or 60 years ago, the kids built of the school, kind of built a set of houses where kids actually had a small town, and they had business. They had a tea house and a post office, and kind of learned about real life that way. So, yeah, it's the campus—it's a neat place.
For MD who hasn't had the privilege of visiting Hillbrook, I think the best thing I can describe it is, if you've ever seen the movie The Parent Trap, where the kids go to summer camp, I think, you know, the Hillbrook campus is almost like the summer camp they go to in that movie.
Yeah.
Actually, when my kids were watching that movie, I actually paused it. I thought, is that actually Hillbrook?
That's right.
I don't think it is, but...
yeah, the contract says we can't talk about that, so... No.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Okay. Let's take a quick break just now, and I'm going to have Bradley come in virtually and tell you about our new sponsor, Tap Typing for iPad.
Hey, everybody. It's Bradley. I want to thank Fraser and the many co-hosts we'll have over the next few weeks while I'm out on paternity leave. But while I'm here, I want to talk to you about a great application called Tap Typing. Tap Typing is an app that teaches students how to type properly on the iPad. It has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard, it has support for all types of external keyboards or cases. Tap Typing is appropriate for all ages and supports multiple user profiles, which is extremely handy for cart-based classroom environments. After just three sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speeds by over 60% on average. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and soothes one of the most painful aspects of the iPad user experience: typing. I personally, at our school, we own over 40 copies of Tap Typing, and I'll be using it, you know, quite a bit this year. I'll probably be adding another 40 here soon. So this is one of those times where I've really put my money where my mouth is with our sponsors. Is this something that we use? And I've used since I heard about it a few years ago when they advertised on the 5x5 network. Our teachers love it. Our students love it. Our technology teacher, when I showed it to her, said this is really what we've been needing to take our iPad productivity to the next level. Again, by the end of the summer, I will own 80 copies of this app for our school. So to learn more about it, go to gettaptyping.com. Again, that's gettaptyping.com, gettaptyping.com, or just search for typing on the App Store. It's the very first result. Again, thanks for the folks at Tap Typing for sponsoring the show this week. So I highly encourage you check it out. Thanks, and we'll see you guys in a few weeks.
So Don, tell us a little bit about the stuff you've been working on with Learning Spaces. I know I've seen your tweets using hashtags like iLab. Am I right?
Exactly. Hillbrook iLab is the
space work that you do.
Yeah, it's really what happened. I'll kind of give you the brief version of the story is, you know, we brought iPads in 2010, did a small pilot with our seventh grade, 40 kids. And when I came in halfway through that year and really noticed a different kind of dynamic happening between teachers and students. And really what I noticed was there was less teacher kind of presentation, less time. The teacher spent less time in the front of the room. Students were really working more together. And, you know, for whatever reason, I think part of it was they had more resources available to them in the iPad. There were more things they could do together with that technology. And so I also noticed that the furniture and the tables were kind of getting in the way of the work they were trying to do. So, you know, they'd want to group up and they'd have to move these tables around or try and move around the tables or sit on the tables. If the teacher was going to work, you know, move from the front of the classroom to work with the students, he or she was trying to get around the tables and move chairs around. So it just seemed like the environment was getting in the way of the learning that everybody wanted to happen. So, so we started thinking about, you know, what can we do? What can we do to fix that? And one of the other kind of goal was to get more technology in the classrooms and get the computer labs offline. So that following year, I took the computer lab offline, had a space to think about doing something with, and we got in touch with Bradford, who makes kind of the Bradford charging carts, and they were looking at some a new line of furniture that was mobile. You know, everything was on wheels. They had folding tables and chairs, and started talking to them, and they were really interested in the same kind of thing. And so I said, let's figure this out. Let's create a prototype space and do some research. Let's figure out how this kind of mobile or agile environment would impact. Does it have an effect on this kind of teaching and learning dynamic? And so for the past 2 years, we've been looking at that.
So this is a space roughly about the size of a traditional computer lab. And when you and I were together, it was basically cleared out. And I think you had, at the time we were together, you had some of those furnitures, but they were probably all stacked up in a corner and I missed them. You had a big open space, and you mentioned you were working on some stuff to do with video.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so
you showed me some of that when we were together as well.
That's right. Yeah. So we have a video camera going in there all the time. And really what we're trying to do, so everything, just again, to give you a picture, it's about 24 feet by 34 feet. So just a plain rectangular room. We put a big whiteboard on one of the walls, about 22 foot by 5 foot whiteboard. And we have some other rolling whiteboards in there and some tables that will fold up and push aside and a couple other tables that have whiteboard tops, and all the chairs are on wheels. I guess a couple of the key features are, one, there isn't a teacher desk, and two, there isn't really a front of the classroom. So we're really looking at kids coming in and building the environment each time. So there's actually a classroom reset. So at the end of a class, everyone puts kind of folds up the furniture and puts it aside so that the room is, like you saw it, kind of open again to be built again for the next class.
And this is a space where teachers would bring a class from their home classroom to this space and work there for what kind of period of time?
Exactly. So the class periods are an hour long, and there's two ways it's used. One, the fifth, sixth grade science teacher, actually, that's her classroom space. And there's a lot of materials too. So she's kind of redesigned her science curriculum to be more challenge-based and design thinking. So they're building, actively working on projects and challenges throughout the course of those classes. And then the other way it's used is teachers coming in to play around with that kind of space or play with the materials and use those.
Okay. And how does the video tie in with that? That's an analysis tool for
exactly. Yeah. So what we wanted to do was not just, I think a lot of schools who are starting to think about, wow, we need to change our learning spaces around, are kind of from the teacher or the adult side, they're kind of saying, well, let's build something cool, let's build something flexible, whatever it is. But there's not usually a whole lot of research behind it. And we really wanted to understand really what's happening. You know, what does this kind of space enable? Is student behavior changing? So we have video going all the time, and we can go back and look at how kids are moving around the classroom. We also have once in a while, as often as we can, an observer going in who's another teacher and just keeping track of the behaviors. So we're looking at engagement, how actively engaged a student is, confidence, how they're participating, you know, are they raising their hand, are they contributing, and then performance, what are they creating in that class, and comparing that data to what happens in a traditional classroom. And so we've been collecting data. Yeah, we've been collecting data for about 2 years now, and have kind of our first analysis of the results just out now.
Okay, so what does that show?
So very cool stuff.
Yeah,
I absolutely can. Yeah, I'll have to kill y'all afterwards, but I can share it. And actually, it's public now, so it shows that actually environment affects behavior. It changes the kind of behavior that happens in a classroom. Whereas basically it's the affordance theory, that a certain kind of environment affords particular kinds of behavior. So a place like the iLab, where everything is mobile, actually encourages students to maximize that, to move things around, to act differently, to behave differently, to feel differently in that space. The other thing is that students, and this is kind of on the non-scientific side of things, the students take ownership of the space more. So they like it more. They're more confident in that space. They act as leaders more. And that's also it's certainly a factor of how the teacher teaches in that space. And teachers have noticed that they can't teach in the same way. They can't be that kind of person in the front directing. It's really more of a collaboration, of a guide, of a facilitator, than somebody who goes in and says, this is what, you know, this is how we're going to run the class from moment to moment.
Okay. And do you think, how is that message being received by your staff? Would you say everyone was on board with that? Or do you have a procedure for sort of rolling that learning out to other members of staff?
Yeah, we there are certain folks who are inclined to try that out. There's a lot more movement. Mm-hmm. And so some teachers are really uncomfortable with so much movement going on. And that's, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of teachers, I think all teachers, use the classroom and space and things and furniture to help manage their classroom, right? You set up your chairs or tables in a circle to encourage a certain kind of behavior or interaction. You set a classroom up in rows to, you know, encourage this. I'm the leader here. You need to pay attention to me. I don't want you socializing with your classmates. And so in the iLab, the difference is that often the students are setting up the space. So a teacher will say, you know, here's the work that you need to do, create kind of a structure of the space that you need to get that work done, whether it's a collaboration space or whether you need a quiet corner in the side. So some teachers are love it. And in fact, next year we'll have 4 more classes that become more like the iLab than anything else. Everything will be mobile and agile, and students will have more control over how that space looks. But there are some teachers that say, you know, I can't manage, it's too much chaos. You know, how do we get work done? And so,
yeah,
it's interesting to see different folks react different ways.
When we started our iPad project, one of the things that we noticed, and I don't know if you've seen similar, is that the teachers that we thought would want a lot of hand-holding for that kind of new style of teaching were actually not the ones we expected, who actually really needed it. And what we found was actually that the older teachers were the ones who were perfectly confident about giving away a lot of that control in the classroom.
Wow.
And it was actually the younger teachers who needed more support to do it.
That's really, that's interesting.
And that's, I don't know if you've looked at that in terms of the age or the experience profile of your teachers, but I think those teachers who are very confident in their classroom management and know they can get the class's attention back at any time often feel much more free to give away that kind of control and then get it back at a certain point, as opposed to younger teachers who perhaps feel that they can, they have to sort of be on top of the class at all times. And if they give away control, they might never get it back if it just gets too chaotic.
No, that's really, I agree. No, I know, you know, when I was teaching, I used to teach English, and I was terrible at classroom management. So there wasn't anything I could do to help out. I just kind of went with it. I remember setting up the classroom. I was like, well, this is not going to help. Hopefully it's just interesting enough that they're stay engaged for a while. But as far as, you know, having any kind of sense of this is going to be a well-managed class or not, I was terrible at that. So I get it, but I certainly need to look at, you know, experience versus new teachers and what that looks like. Have you noticed kind of new kinds of dynamics happening or at your school?
A little bit. Because our building is both an old building and a listed building and was not a purpose-built building for a school, we're actually really constrained in what we can do in some of the spaces. Without knocking down a lot of walls that we're not really supposed to knock down because it's a
details, details.
details.
No one has to know.
Regulations. Yeah. we try not to knock down structural parts.
Yeah, that's useful.
I think in some cases, we've certainly seen that some classes are starting to change their shape a little bit. And we're looking at certain other things because the summer's just started for us, and one of the things we're looking at is lighting in the classroom. Because we have such a kind of dark winter in Scotland. You know,
oh my god!
From basically August to March every year.
I've been there, man. that was killer.
Yeah, it's a tough part of the year. But one of the things that we noticed was, and this is kind of perhaps, I don't know if this shows up in your kind of analysis, but below the level of the classroom down to the individual's desk, the way the children arrange themselves on their desk or arrange their equipment on their desk, I should say, is we sense very heavily influenced by the lighting in the classroom.
Huh.
Because where we have, you know, the traditional idea is that you have lights in the ceiling that fire straight down onto the table, so you get the maximum light on the desk.
Mm.
In fact, when you have a piece of glass on your desk that's reflective, that's actually quite problematic. And we end up looking at children sitting, you know, propping up the iPad with one hand and typing with the other,
huh,
just to get that glare and reflection off their screen.
Yeah.
And we're starting to look at different possibilities for designing lighting in the classroom, because that is something we can change quite easily for most of the classrooms.
Yeah,
and we're looking at, you know, softer and bounce lighting and things like that.
Right, that kind of that. The indirect lighting that has the shields that basically reflect it off the ceiling, so you get a dispersed kind of light.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think lighting is huge. I mean, think about, you know, just for your own experience, you know, you walk into a space, and I think this goes, you know, it's funny because we've forgotten about this in schools. We just assume that a classroom has to look like this, and these are the basic mm-hmm. requirements. But, you know, as a normal person walking around the world, you know, we're deeply influenced by our environments. You know, you walk into a coffee shop, or you walk into a pub, or you walk into an outdoor space, you know, that everything about that space affects you, and, you know, affects your mood, affects your, you know, how well you think, how creative you feel. And so, and lighting is a huge piece of that. So,
absolutely.
So it makes sense. You can make huge changes to an environment just by changing lighting.
Yeah. And it's becoming an interesting challenge now, because, I mean, it used to be you went and bought a light bulb.
Yeah, that's right.
Now you need a kind of degree in electronics and electrical engineering to try and decide what kind of light fitting you're going to put in your school.
Yeah.
But we're looking at a range of different LED and spotlight products to try and figure out what's the best thing to do. And also different kinds of paint finish as well for the ceilings. So
yeah.
if you're going to bounce light, there's a lot of different paint finishes you can use, and we're not totally sure what the best thing is yet. We've only just started looking at the options, but I think that's something that when you kind of become deeply embedded in portable devices and particularly tablet devices, where, you know, their orientation in the room is changing all the time.
Yeah.
Then if you can avoid that kind of point light source being visible on the screen, then that really, really helps.
Yeah, that's you know, I hadn't even thought about that reflective piece. And we have, you know, there's fluorescent lighting in a lot of our rooms, and, you know, it's in the iLab too. And it's something I wanted to change, and just kind of budget wise, we couldn't do it. But it's funny because we just I just moved to a new space with my colleagues, kind of with the tech guy who works with me and the communications director. And the one thing about the space is it has no windows, which is killer, which is just, you know, I think, you know.
Especially when you've got all that nice sunlight.
Oh, exactly. You know, the world is moving out there, and there's a sun and everything, and you're in this space. So the first thing I kind of battled for was, like, don't give me fluorescent lighting, please. Whatever you do, you know, I need something else. So, you know, thank goodness the door has a little window in it, but it makes a huge difference to have natural lighting, you know. And so you look at, you know, those kind of sun channels that some people build in the roof, things mm-hmm. like that are expensive, obviously, to do. But I think more and more there are ways to get electric lighting looking more natural and less, like you said, like the floodlight kind of thing, but more dispersed. Yeah. And then color too, right? The color of the ceiling. You know, no mm-hmm. one ever thinks about it. They just assume, well, we got to paint the ceiling white, but there's probably other things you can do. You know, do you have like a kind of a warm white versus a, you know, just a bright white or something like that to help disperse some of the lighting?
Yeah, just change that tone a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm actually moving into a new classroom. This is partly why we're redesigning some of this stuff, because we changed our art classroom. We moved our art teacher into another classroom and changed our art classroom into a sort of joint computer science chemistry lab kind of situation.
Oh, cool.
And this is why we're rebuilding this. We're kind of growing our science provision quite a lot at the moment. So it's just an opportunity to start looking at different things and seeing what works and what doesn't. And I'll try and report back at some point and see what's the best. But we've got a few options right now.
I'd love to hear it. And I think it's so easy for... It's funny because even, you know, for us who, you know, we've been fairly invested in this whole learning spaces conversation for over two years now. And, you know, sitting with our admin team a couple months ago, and somebody said, you know, okay, this classroom needs some new furniture. So, and the conversation went, okay, well, let's just buy the furniture and let's do it. You know, what did we buy 10 years ago? Let's get the same thing. And I'm like, I'm sitting here. What am I hearing? I'm sitting here.
Because you know there's a company somewhere who is still building the same thing that you bought 10
years ago.
You know
it's there. And, you know, it's not like there's nothing wrong. There's nothing necessarily wrong with what exists out there, but it's just a matter of like, I think we need to be thoughtful about what we're doing, like be more conscious. You know, learning has changed, right? With these devices in the classrooms now, kids are much more mobile. You know, they can move around in ways they just couldn't do before for a whole lot of different reasons. I think teaching has changed. You know, there's more kind of student-directed learning possible. And so all those things really require a different kind of environment. So you have to think about, people ask me all the time, they say, you know, well, we've got this new space, we're redesigning, what should we do? And I always ask them, like, what are you trying to do in the classroom? What kind of learning and teaching do you want to happen? What do you want learning and teaching to look like? Because if you don't know that answer, then I can't just say, well, here's the best model of a room, classroom. This is what the classroom looks like or should look like. It's more about what kind of things do you want to do there? What do you want to allow to happen? What do you want to afford to happen? So...
And the challenge is now that because the computer comes with the student, that you don't have to, you can't or don't have to build a specific room for one specific mode of using a computer, which is sitting at a desk, typically facing the front. I mean, one of the things that we found when we moved from having a computer lab of iMacs to having iPads in the classroom was that the desks were just way, way too big.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they were 80 by 80 centimeter desks. Yeah. And we had this, you know, tiny little 9.7 inch display on the front. And the kids were, you know, we put the desks kind of, instead of being in rows, we changed them to be sort of back to back. So the children were facing each other.
Uh-huh.
And there was, 160 centimeters of distance between them. And, you know, the noise was unbearable because everybody had to shout at each other because of the distance.
So far, you know what you do? You need more textbooks. Just get more textbooks. And just fill up the desk with textbooks. It's all good like that.
I hear that's popular in America.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a very expensive piece of furniture.
Just stack them up. You can make walls. You can do all sorts of things with them.
Yeah, so that was an interesting challenge. We persevered with that for a couple of years just for budget reasons, but it was very quickly, very obviously not ideal. And it's fascinating to see, you know, if you were to build a space for, you know, mobile learning with mobile devices, you would not build it in any way provisioned in the same fashion as you would have built a space even for desktops or laptop computers. You know, the classroom that our art teacher's going into used to be my computer lab, and there are power plates in the floor and Ethernet jacks in the floor that will never be used again for computers.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's keeping them because she wants the power plates for glue guns for the art classroom, but she doesn't want the Ethernet at all.
No, it's so interesting. It's really true. It's changed. The needs of a space has changed now. Like, I'm curious what you think about the whole desktop thing. Like, when would you need a desktop? You know, because people are saying, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people and they're really skeptical about, you know, well, we want a place, you know, where people can do higher end computing and things like that. And I said, why not? You know, if you need to, why don't you get some laptops? But then like, well, I don't know, laptops, you know, we really need desktops. We really need big desktops that are kind of all ready to go. What do you think about that?
Well, to put my sysadmin hat on for a second, I think the biggest challenge with portable devices is, where people haven't kind of moved over to the thought of one-to-one devices, right? So where you have laptops in a shared situation, the biggest problem is syncing the user's data back and forth between a local hard drive and some server so that, you know, different people can use that laptop. If you're one-to-one in your laptops, then fine, you know, have a high-end computer in your bag or whatever, but... the reason that many people sort of still hang on to desktops is because with desktops, you can plug an Ethernet jack in the back and you can do it at an acceptable speed. Whereas, you know, if you've used portable home directories on OS X server or, you know, I mean, everybody knows that everybody who's had laptops where you have to log into them at the start of the class, everybody knows what a disastrous kind of user experience that is.
Right.
And I think the desire for desktops is because, to a certain extent, when you talk about that kind of higher end computing, people are, you're talking about things where it's large pieces of data.
Right.
Typically.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a good point.
It's video and audio production, things like that. And there is a solution to this, and the solution is one-to-one laptops. But yeah, that's a very, very, very expensive option for almost everybody. And I mean, sure, it was never really on the table for us either. But I know that, I don't know if you're familiar with the PSU Mac Admins conference that happens in the East Coast once a year. But there was something came out of that conference, I think it was last year, where somebody well known in the Mac sort of sysadmin community said, he said, look, you know, portable home directories are dead because data demand has just killed it. You know, the idea of logging in to your profile on a laptop remotely from a server is just a dead concept.
It's crazy, I agree.
And you should just stop doing it. And I think that's really what is keeping people onto desktops, is because you need a shared computer to do things with big data, and basically Wi-Fi connected laptops are not cutting it anymore.
Yeah.
And I certainly have some sympathy with that point of view. You know, kitting out a lab of desktop computers for one or two specific bits of the curriculum is probably a really nice option if your budget can justify it, and if that teaching that material is important enough to your school that you can justify that part of your budget. But to me, you know, I don't think we never taught media production or you know, video production or anything like that before we went to iPad. And in fact, we do more now with our iPads because it's more convenient than we ever did with when we had laptops and FireWire video cameras and iMovie.
Yeah, it's true. You've got it all right in one place, and it's, you know, you're not dealing with moving data back and forth and things like that, which takes a ton of time. But that's a good point. I mean, I feel like, you know, you're the guy who talked about not, you know, logging into home directories and having profiles, you know, mobile profiles. I mean, we moved away from that last year. It just was not worth it. So, you know, all our Mac laptops that are floating around are really just are logged in. There's a single profile. You know, there's an admin profile underneath, but otherwise, people are using the same kind of profiles and just using cloud-based tools. And, you know, more and more, there's cloud-based video editing stuff, too. And we're an elementary school, so, you know, the majority of the work is kind of lower end. But, I mean, that's changing, too.
The scale
right?
is
I mean,
less. Yeah.
Yeah, the scale is less. But we do, you know, that said, we do have a little iMac lab kind of off to the side that folks do their video and photo editing on. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, as far as future goes, like I would rather have more spaces to do more interesting things than fixed purpose spaces.
Yeah, I mean, is if you were to budget it, if you had to build the room as well as kit it out, then you know, the budget cost would be astronomical, you know. And it's something that, you know, schools who have gone to mobile devices, they don't always consider the fact that they also get back a room or two rooms or three rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
Or four rooms, you know, however many, you know, IT labs a big school has, those can all be brought back into use for other things.
Or they just keep them and forget that they have that option, which is craziness.
Well, you know, that happened to us. I mean, we took the lab away on the first day, but we still had our portable Macs. And the thing that is just kind of astonishing to me and has been brought home to me because I just decommissioned our OS X server last
week.
Nice.
You have a funeral? Funeral?
I sort of ceremoniously put his hard drive in a sealed box just in case I ever needed that data. But, you know, that was never part of the plan, to obsolete the Mac at Cedars was never part of the plan. And I thought, well, maybe that'll happen in, you know, 6 years' time or something, but we'll always have this parallel world. And in fact, it just dropped off a cliff. Because of convenience, speed, ease of use, self-contained nature of the device, all of these things just destroyed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So we still have some laptops floating around for sure, but I do think they will go. But there's, you know, there's resistance for sure. I mean, when I took the computer lab offline, there was a, you know, not so many people were happy about that. There were certainly the folks who are used to going into the computer lab and doing their, you know, little drawings with the mouse, you know, but that was, I mean, the funny thing about that is that parents were getting a printout of a picture, right? So there was some evidence of computer use. Mm-hmm. And teachers also got a break and could say, you know, well, our kids are learning technology and they're going in there and doing it, and it's once a week. And so when we took it offline, we didn't really have, you know, and you know, we didn't have a way to market kind of the shift. And and that, you know, that's significant. I think you really need to pay attention to, even though I think the work that was being done in the computer lab wasn't brilliant, it was still, there was evidence of technology, you know, and people wanted that.
Yeah, I think certainly as time goes by, more and more, you know, you solve one challenge, you get to another challenge. And I think there's a couple of challenges right now that are coming to the fore for schools that have kind of gone down the route of one-to-one mobile devices. And I think the three that are kind of exercising my mind right now are long-term data storage. Number two is archival of, you know, showpiece bits of work that students do, portfolio kind of issues. And then the third one is filtering when you go off network. And I think that's something that we're probably going to attack the third one of those first and try and solve a problem of how we help parents have some confidence that the devices that we're sending home have similar kinds of filtering on other networks that they do in our network as well. And we're not quite there yet, but I think it's, we're coming along with that, and I can see ways around that in the future.
Well, and I think that that's something we'll probably talk about next time too, you know, the whole digital citizenship piece, because I think, you know, kids have,
for sure,
you know, so you do have the argument that kids with school devices, you know, the school is sort of responsible for that. Whereas as soon as they go home, they have access to all sorts of things that the school and parents don't necessarily have to have control over. You know, what is the, do you think about that differently, or do you just kind of, you know, what do you do? Well, we can talk about that next time. It's a whole nother.
We should definitely talk about that the next time. I mean, I think it's interesting to me that the only time I've actually had a complaint about content that was being accessed at home was that one parent told me that her child was obsessed with watching a certain TV program on BBC iPlayer, which is kind of like the UK's version of Hulu Plus or whatever. Uh-huh. And she was just watching that, you know, constantly. and could I turn off BBC iPlayer for her? But that was it.
Can't you do that? We'll definitely talk about that. You can turn it off, right? Come on, turn it off. Just turn it off.
Maybe just pull the plug on it. I'll just make a phone call. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Can you just shut down the whole system? Just at night. Just night here.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said to her. I said, look, you know, turn your Wi-Fi off.
Yeah. Well, exactly. There's all sorts of ways. But yeah, this is definitely a whole can of worms right there.
It certainly is. But yeah, next, you're going to be on the show in a couple of weeks' time, Dawn, again, and thanks for coming on again. Mm. We'll definitely talk more about digital citizenship then, because you said at the start that you have a lot of these sort of startup companies and organizations on your doorstep, and one of those is Common Sense Media. Am I
exactly,
right?
Yeah. Yep.
And tell us a little bit about your relationship with them. Just trail the next show for 2 weeks away.
Yeah. No, we actually kind of built a really close relationship with them over the past couple of years. You know, we helped them kind of develop the One-to-One Essentials program that they launched a few months ago. And really, we work closely with their education department kind of on what kind of responsibility of school is, what the responsibility of parents are, and how do you bring that into the school. And particularly, I would say one of my kind of highest priorities next year is the whole digital citizenship piece and what that program looks like at our school. And how do we, you know, share that responsibility with parents? So they're great. You know, they're really responsive, and I think their approach, which is really education, not restriction, is key, mm-hmm. particularly in a world where kids have more and more access to devices. So we can only block so much, and the kids will have unfettered access at some point, you know, along the way. And it's becoming younger and younger, right? They're texting mm-hmm. from their parents' phones and their iPads and iPods and all of that. So, you know, you can only control and create the padded room so much. So I think more and more we need to help them make good decisions and teach them kind of how to operate in that world responsibly.
Excellent. So I certainly look forward to talking to you a lot more about that. I think that probably deserves a whole show in itself, and I think it'll be interesting to dig into some of the issues around that.
Absolutely. And do you know Common Sense Media's their new graphite kind of software that's out there, or program that it's basically rates it.
I don't know that, no.
Oh, you need to check it out. They launched it at ISTE a couple weeks ago, and it's really them rating apps and software and websites for educational kind of value. So, you know, they're trying to capture that all and give teachers some kind of a rating system to help them choose.
Now that certainly sounds like something that's required for sure.
Yeah. Certainly helps out.
Before we wrap up, Don, because time is running on with us here, I wanted to ask you also about your involvement with the EdTech Teacher organization.
Sure. Yeah. Recently joined the EdTech Teacher team, who they're a fantastic group out of the East Coast, but now really spread out nationally, and they offer professional development around technology, really, for schools and for organizations. But their approach is excellent. It's really, I think certainly in line with yours and mine, Fraser, about it's not just about the device. It's about good teaching and learning, good curriculum, and how do we kind of empower schools to really integrate these, the technology as one of their other tools, kind of in the toolkit. So they're fantastic. I think I certainly joined up with them because I really respected their approach, and they're really they offer PD for schools kind of in a challenge-based model. So it's a lot of hands-on work, which I found really effective, much more effective than your kind of traditional workshop model where someone goes up there, says, click here, click there, do this. It's more about how does this apply, go play, figure it out, and let's get back and talk about it and see how it fits in.
Okay. And do they talk to school management as well? Is there a kind of school development plan kind of approach to it as well?
Yeah, they do. I think that, ideally, often I think they're brought in for schools who are bringing, most recently, schools who are bringing in iPads or big rollouts of iPads, and they need some teacher education. They do longer term professional development kind of through the course of the year. And I know they do work with school leadership too, but I mean, I think you and I know that if the school leadership aren't on board and it's just kind of a, let's learn some basic skills. That's not the whole picture.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, everything that we know about school improvement begins and ends with school leadership, and whether that's, a bullying policy or a, curriculum development thing or a technology thing, school leadership's always stated as one of the most important things in any kind of change process in a school, and technology is no different.
No, exactly. And we just had, I told you about it, but we just did a 3-day seminar at Hillbrook, right before ISTE. And the goal was to bring school teams, to the seminar. Really, we wanted a combination of, technology folks, leadership and teachers, really, so everyone part of that team understood the whole process, understood both the big picture of kind of the bigger decisions and the shift in schedule or budget or, leadership or professional development, what that looks like, but also what it takes to build a really good lesson, using technology. And that was neat and really successful. Yeah.
Great. Well, we'll be interested to hear more about that as time goes on as well, for sure. So I think we're getting on for close to an hour. I've noticed a kind of backlash on Twitter against a 1.5 to 2 hour podcast recently. So I've been aiming to try and keep the school a little snappier recently. We went long a couple of weeks ago talking about iOS 7 and WWDC and things like that. But
That'll do it. Come on. What is it?
It's almost to talk about.
Yeah, but it's almost 12 o'clock there. What else you got to do? You got hours.
Yep.
You can sleep.
Nothing.
Come on.
I'm on holiday today and I'm going home tomorrow, and when I get off this call, we're going to pack the house up and go home. So, we'll get there.
Yeah.
But Don, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And I know Bradley appreciates you filling in for him as well.
Yeah, no, love it. Love talking to you.
Always. And we're going to have next week, I'm going to be talking to one of my colleagues from Cedars, and then we're going to have you back on in 2 weeks' time, and where we're going to talk a lot about the Common Sense Media stuff that we just mentioned, and also digital citizenship, which is a topic that could probably take a month worth of podcast by itself.
Sure.
And we could probably spend the first couple of hours just trying to decide what citizenship is itself.
Yeah. I'm game for the challenge.
But that'll be a topic for a couple of weeks' time.
Great.
So again, Don, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.